Welcome to Sports Business Secrets. I'm your host, Kevin Tarka. This podcast is specifically designed to share secrets from experts in the sports business world to help you along your own path to success in this industry. Each episode is packed with lessons and insights that never expire. You'll hear from general managers of professional teams to CEOs of sports tech companies to agents, coaches, players, and everything in between. I invite you to join me in real time on my personal journey of representing players and coaches, traveling the world, and always finding a way to battle through obstacles in this competitive industry.
Alan, welcome to Sports Business Secrets.
Oh, it's so great to be with you. I'm looking forward to a fun conversation.
No doubt. So I usually share, I usually start by sharing a quick story about my guests. And although that we haven't been able to meet in person yet, I will say, hopefully in the least weird way, you come up pretty often in my life. Almost every single time I go to the grocery store, I think about you. And do you know why?
I have a feeling I do. Yes. My hard stance on returning shopping carts to their corrals.
100%. So yeah, every time, the first time I heard that stance, it stuck with me. You know, I consider myself like a pretty nice person and professional guy, but every once in a while it was like, I was kind of lazy, or I'm like, you know, I'll just leave it here. I'll push it closer. But now let me tell you, that thing is back right in its corral, exactly where it's supposed to be every single time.
Well, I love it. I appreciate you doing your part. And it's, you know, if everybody would simply do their part, and I say that both literally and metaphorically, as cliche as it sounds, the world would be a much better place.
For sure. Well, I figured I'd start with that one. So let me do a brief little intro here for some of the listeners or the audience who might be living under a rock and they don't know who Alan Stein Jr. is. Alan is a former collegiate basketball player who has turned his passion for the game into a lifelong career. After graduating from Elon, he co-founded his own high-performance strength training service that focused on youth athletes. He then shifted into training top-level high school athletes and coaches, which included significant time working with the legendary basketball programs Montrose Christian and DeMatha. He's worked with quite literally the highest performing basketball players on the planet, including players like Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Kobe Bryant, many others. And Alan now focuses his time helping individuals and organizations maximize their performance. He's a speaker, a coach, an author, a consultant, a dad, and he's definitely one of the best storytellers that I've listened to. So I'm honored to have him on here with me today to share some wisdom here.
Well, what a thoughtful intro. I appreciate that very much. And, you know, I have the humility to know, I would imagine the vast majority of your audience has no idea who I am. So it's always an honor for me to meet somebody new, but to have an opportunity to share some thoughts and some ideas and strategies and stories with a new audience. So I'm excited for a fun conversation. And, you know, I want to pull on that thread of the shopping cart story for just a moment. And then we can certainly take this wherever you think would be most helpful. But a good friend and mentor of mine, Jay Billis, most know him as kind of the face of college basketball at ESPN. You know, I've known Jay since 2007 when we worked some of the Nike Skills Academies together. And one of his primary mantras is to always leave everything better than you found it. And once again, as I said earlier, he means this quite literally and figuratively. But, you know, it's this belief that whether you're somewhere for 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 months, 5 years, or 5 decades, you should make every attempt to leave it better than you found it. And that was really the impetus, that mindset of why I've always been so hell-bent on returning my shopping cart when I'm done. Because that's just, to me, a very small sign of doing the right thing, having some discipline, but leaving something better than you found it. And, you know, I've kind of changed my stance a little bit over the years. Whereas, you know, if you followed some of my work 3, 4, 5 years ago, I would make a statement that now in hindsight is just too judgmental and too critical. I would say that anyone who left their shopping cart in the middle of a parking space in the parking lot, who abandoned their shopping cart, was lazy, entitled, and selfish. And I realize I'm in no position to judge anybody through that limited snapshot. What I've now done is pivoted slightly, my language more in particular, and say in that moment, that person did something that was lazy, entitled, or selfish. And I think that's probably a more fairer assessment. And, you know, all of us are going to have moments of weakness. All of us are going to have moments when we're not our best self. All of us, including myself, will absolutely have moments of being selfish or entitled or lazy. So that's why I've kind of made that shift. I don't want to pretend for 1 second that I know the reason someone abandons their shopping cart. I don't know what's going on in their life. I don't know what's going on, you know, even that day. I don't know if they, you know, so I want to get away from judgment and criticism as a personal trait and lean in more with curiosity and fascination. So where it used to bother me when someone would abandon their cart, I realized life is too short to let something that trivial bother me. Now, when I see it, I still believe it's an act of selfishness and laziness, entitlement, but I don't even blink. I take the cart myself and I go return it, because at least that's another opportunity or repetition for me to do something of good, for me to have some discipline, and for me to leave something better than I found it.
Yeah, I love that shift too, because you really never know what someone's going through, and it could just be a bad day for them. And so, you know, it still keeps in the perspective that in that moment, they probably could have made a better decision, but, you know, it's leaving the judgment out. So love that. So I really want to dive into the meat and potatoes here of the conversation. So we don't have to spend too much time on like growing up and, you know, getting into sports, but I do like to hear, you know, all my guests on kind of how they got involved with sports. And, you know, did you have, like myself, like many others, like, cause you're obviously involved with basketball and other sports, did you have that dream when you were young to make it to the NBA?
So you're telling me you don't want to talk about shopping carts for 60 minutes?
I bet we could. And it would still be impactful.
I'm just messing with you. Yes, absolutely. You know, basketball was my first love. And even though I'm knocking on the door of 50 years old, I still vividly remember falling in love with the game at 5 years old. So, you know, we're talking 4.5 decades later, basketball's still a major pillar of my life and a major passion. And, you know, basketball has kind of been the one consistent red thread for the last 45 years of my life. I mean, I was a very dedicated player. As you mentioned in my bio, was able to play collegiately up through Elon University, then immediately became a basketball performance coach. And then in 2017, I decided to leave that world and focus on corporate keynote speaking and writing. But if you follow my work, you'll see that most of the themes and strategies and ideas I share come through the lens of a former basketball performance coach. And many of the stories and reference points are from the things I learned from the game. But yes, when I was growing up, especially in my elementary and middle school years, I had the dreams of being an NBA player. When I got to high school and a little bit of reality started to set in, and you know, I realized that, you know, playing in the NBA or playing professionally most likely wasn't in the cards for me, but that I was still able to do something that only 1% of all basketball players get to do. And that's the play in college. So when I feel like I kind of maxed out the level that I could play, I knew that I still wanted to be heavily involved in the game. I still wanted to be around the game. I wanted to be able to leave my thumbprint on the game. And that's why I decided to become a basketball performance coach. So it wasn't like my dreams were shattered and, you know, it was NBA or bust. You know, I think most little kids who kind of live in their own little bubble, you know, and in my case, you know, I thought, hey, I'm the best player at my elementary school, or I'm the best player on my block. That's probably good enough to play in the NBA. Because when you're that little, you don't realize how many elementary schools there are and how many streets and blocks there are, that just being the good player in your neighborhood doesn't mean you're going to be able to play with the elite. But, you know, basketball has afforded me so many unbelievable and unparalleled experiences. You know, I've traveled the world. I've met so many amazing people. You know, most of the good things that have occurred in my life aren't within a few degrees of the game of basketball. So it's not like I was shortchanged because I wasn't able to make it to the NBA.
Without a doubt. And that's so important too. You know, one of the, since a lot of listeners, or at least a handful of them, are aspiring pros, one of the topics that's near and dear to my heart is, you know, look, you hear it all the time, the ball is going to stop bouncing, but it is. And so my direction is, okay, if you want to make the NBA, fantastic. First of all, you need to take the steps that are necessary to do that. But if not, there's some really cool shit you could do with this sport in your life and impact that you can make without getting paid to be a pro. So for you, going in quotes pro in something other than your sport, like, what, I guess you talked about realizing you might not go, but talk about finding that new identity, because I really think a lot of athletes struggle with that, whether it's from high school no longer playing, from college no longer playing, or after their pro career. A lot of athletes struggle with finding their new identity outside of being an athlete. So talk [S2] Absolutely. [S1] About your process in that.
Well, I'm so glad that this direction you wanted to go. One of the things when I was still in the basketball space and I was doing a lot of speaking to young players, and when I say young players, I was talking about anyone below college age, so even high school, I would say something and it was a little bit of wordplay and I did it to catch their attention. I'd be with a group of 500 players, you know, sitting in a gym, and I would say, every single one of you can make it to the NBA. And then I'd pause for a second because obviously they've never heard anyone say that. And I said, but it's very unlikely that you'll make it there as a player. But there are so many different jobs and so many different roles in the NBA itself. And if it was really young kids, we'd have fun and I'd get them to shout out some of the jobs. And, you know, I mean, you could be anything from, you know, an NBA owner to a referee to someone that does ticket sales to the mascot, if you will. But if your goal is to make it to the NBA, the premier league for basketball, you know, you can do that if that is your goal. Just know that making it as one of the 450 players is really, really challenging. And I never said that to squash anyone's dream. I would never tell a kid that they won't be able to make it there as a player. I just always believe in brushing it with a stroke of reality to let them know how challenging that part is, but to not be discouraged. Let the game take you as far as you can, and you take the game as far as you can. And then when you realize that, you know, that road is starting to narrow in that specific niche, you can pivot to do something else, just like I did. When my playing days were coming to a close, I made a distinct pivot to be a coach or to be a performance coach. And, you know, as far as identity, it just depends on your perspective and how you choose to look at it. I mean, I'm technically right now, I'm just a weekend warrior, but I still heavily identify with being an athlete. I view myself as if I am a competitive athlete. You know, I train, I sleep, I eat, I prepare for my keynotes as if I am still an athlete, because that's something that gives me comfort. But yes, the identity shift of, if you view yourself solely as a basketball player and you believe that your only gift to the world or your only benefit or your only self-worth is derived because you are a basketball player, then when you are no longer a basketball player, you're going to have some identity issues, understandably. If you simply acknowledge that basketball is not who I am, basketball is what I do, but I'm a multifaceted human being. Basketball is something I'm incredibly passionate about. It's something I want to play for as long as I can, but it's not who I am. I have other parts of my life and other interests and other things that I'm good at. Basketball is just one spoke on the wheel. Then I think it's easier to make that transition. And of course, that's very easy for me to say. I'm in no place to judge, you know, a high school or college player who is an elite level basketball player who, you know, their name and the word basketball are borderline synonymous at this point in their life because they've given everything they can to the game. I'm not saying that it's easy to view it that way, but that's certainly the first step. Is basketball is not who you are. It's something that you do. And I think that's the first step to being able to have a more holistic identity.
Yeah, that's a great way. I love the way you put it. If your only gift is playing basketball, it can be a powerful gift and you can make a lot of impact, but if that's your only gift, if that's how you identify your self-worth, then it's going to lead you down a dark path, I think. But, you know, again, summarizing, there is a fine balance between saying, look, you can do it, reach for the stars, go for your dreams, but here's the reality. If you think it's going to be easy, then you're also in for a dark path, because it's not going to be easy, because you do need to have elite performance, elite mindset, elite skill set, right? So on that topic of elite performance and mindset, I think first, maybe can you share with the audience, like when you say elite performance, what does that mean? Like what does elite performance mean? And then I have some additional questions on mindset, but to be an elite performer, unpack that for us, because there's a lot that goes into that.
Well, I'm going to put a pin in that for 1 second, and I promise that I will answer it. But one thing that I think is important to understand, one of the reasons I'm such a huge advocate of sports in general, especially at the youth ages, and particularly basketball, is because of the traits and the skill sets that you develop in the game. And those traits and skill sets are highly transferable. You know, as I said, I'm a weekend warrior. I'm not a competitive athlete at present, but I view my speaking engagements and I approach my speaking engagements the same way I would as if I was an NBA player. You know, I have a pregame routine before I take the stage. I'm very conscious of what I eat and my sleep. And I go through rehearsal just like a basketball player would go through practice. So I still approach the game as if I was, or approach speaking as if I was still a basketball player. And then when you look at the traits of discipline and habits and mindset and focus and being a part of a team and collaboration and cohesion and communication and culture, you know, all of these things, accountability, work ethic, respect. I mean, it's almost an infinite list of traits that we can develop and then improve upon when we're in sport. And I just want to make sure that anyone who is doing that can transfer those and use those skills of high utility in any area of their life. So that's why when the ball does stop bouncing, as you said, you have the ability to take those skill sets and everything you learn and redirect them into something else. And that does take an identity shift, but keep in mind that, you know, when you're playing the game of basketball, you are doing more than just learning how to shoot, pass, rebound, defend, and handle the ball. You know, those skills aren't necessarily transferable in any area of life, but things like leadership, communication, accountability, discipline, those things are. Now, back to your original question about performance, there's really two lenses at which we can look at elite performance. You know, the first is kind of intrinsically. And I think an elite performance is any performance where you maximized your ability, any performance where you gave the best effort you were capable of, had the best effort that you were capable of giving, you know, had a quote unquote winner's mindset. You know, if you go out and you do anything in your life to the very best of your ability, I consider that an elite performance. Now, of course, the other side of that is the extrinsic, is kind of the comparative game. How does that performance stack up against others? And I think it's important for us to pay attention to both. I mean, ultimately for me, at this point in my life, the intrinsic and having the self-satisfaction of knowing I did the best I was capable of is what I find most fulfilling. You know, I'm personally not very driven by someone thinking I'm a better speaker than someone else, or where do I stack amongst authors or keynote speakers? You know, I'm a competitor, and of course I want to be looked at favorably, and it's nice to receive praise and compliments, but I don't really have much control over the comparative side. You know, what I do control is, can I show up for this client and get on stage as the best version of myself, fully prepared to deliver value in the best manner possible? And if I can do that, then I feel like that was an elite performance. Whether or not someone says you're a good speaker or you're the best speaker we've ever seen, it doesn't matter. To me, it's more on the intrinsic side. But, you know, if your goal is to be an NBA player, well, there is a comparative nature to that. You know, you on some level, the decision makers have to decide that you're one of the 450 best players in the world to have an opportunity to do that. It's not good enough just to say, hey, I did my best, so I should be, you know, getting a scholarship, or, hey, I played as hard as I could, so I should be in the NBA. The world doesn't work that way, right? But I still think you can consider your performance elite, even if it doesn't necessarily stack up against the elite.
Yeah, let's double click that for a second. That's I actually haven't ever heard it phrased that way, intrinsic versus extrinsic. But obviously, you know, you have to balance the fact that, you know, you have to try hard and you have to be, you know, proud of the way you competed. But at the end of the day, results do matter, right? And so, to a certain extent, you are going to be compared to someone else. So, for the, let's say, the high school athlete, the general high school athlete who is aspiring to be a collegiate scholarship player. And, you know, you have these rankings now, and you have these highlights, and you have the whole social media side. What do you say to that athlete who is almost putting too much pressure on themselves to these subjective, for the most part, rankings that are out there? Like, how do you advise them to balance that?
Well, my advice, and this holds true across the board, regardless of age or regardless of industry or vocation, is to put your focus on the things you have control over and try to untether and let go from the things that you don't. You control what your attitude is. You control how hard you work. You control your discipline. You control how consistent you are. You know, you control whether or not you're an energy giver on your team or an energy drainer. You control your body language. You know, those are the things you have control over. So that's what you need to put your focus on. You don't have control over where someone else subjectively ranks you. You don't have control over, you know, what the referee does, or even what your coach says, or what the fans say, or what any scouting report says. You don't have control over those things. So as easy as this is for me to say, I know it is really challenging to do, but put your focus on the things you have control over, and then you just got to be confident and collected enough to just let the chips fall where they may. You know, there's if you start trying to focus on what you need to do to jockey for a certain position on the rankings, well, there's a good chance those things aren't in alignment with what's best for your development as a player or what's best for your team. You know, let's never forget basketball is a team sport by design. So, you know, one of the worst things you can do as a teammate is to have this mentality of, well, I'm just going to go for mine. So my stats are great. So I get a chance to be ranked. Well, what if going for yours is not the role you're supposed to play on the team or is not what's best for the team? You know, you start taking my turn shots because you're looking to get, you know, increase your scoring average. And if those aren't good shots for the team, you give your team less of a chance to be successful. You know, so I'm a big believer in focusing on the things you have control over and then just letting the chips fall where they may. Now, with that said, again, I'm a realist. You know, I understand preferences. You know, if I was an elite high school player, I'd prefer to be ranked number 10 than to be ranked number 100. That would be my preference, of course. And there's nothing wrong with having that preference. But the only way you can actually improve that ranking is by zeroing back in and focusing on being the best player you're capable of, the best teammate that you're capable of, you know, and doing everything you can to win. I think a lot of players forget that in the name of the game in basketball is to win the game. It's to have more points on the scoreboard than your opponent. And most coaches and most scouting services, if they know what they're doing, will place a very high value on someone that executes their role within the team to the best of their ability in order to help the team win, even if their points per game or assists per game or rebounds per game is a little bit less. You know, most of the elite coaches I've been around would rather see someone sacrifice some of the me for the we and say, yeah, this kid averages, you know, 15, 8, and 4, but his team wins. And he does all of the things to help the team win. Whereas this player over here, you know, is averaging 20 and 12 and 8, but they don't do the little things to help the team win. They're more concerned about how they look and how their stats look than they are about their team. Coaches are thinking, I don't want a guy like that on my team. You know, I want someone who is selfless, not someone who is selfish.
Yeah. And you mentioned stats a lot. I think, you know, elite performers, at least from the comparative side, stats are going to be a big factor in that because they are going to go into your rankings. But my question for you is, how do you identify where there's no data for, or maybe there is data for an elite mindset? Like, obviously, you know, I talk about a lot when I'm scouting and recruiting, you find the kid that, you know, is at the end of the bench not playing and they're the happiest and they're giving the most high fives and they're, you know, they're playing their role, or the kid that dives on every single loose ball, right? Is that more of a mindset? Like, does that fall under the mindset category? Like, how do you define a winner's mindset and an elite mindset?
Well, my definition of a winner's mindset is always making the commitment to do the best you can with what you have wherever you are. Full stop. Do the best you can with what you have wherever you are. And the reason I love that as an operating system, if you will, is it automatically eliminates a trilogy of behaviors that undermine performance, undermine productivity, undermine your stats, undermine your fulfillment and enjoyment. And that's blaming, complaining, and making excuses. Blaming, complaining, and making excuses will erode every portion of both individual and organizational performance. You know, it'll erode your ability to be the best player you can be, but it'll absolutely erode your team's ability to be the best that it can be. So we all need to work to reduce the temptation to blame, complain, and make excuses. So that's why you can literally be the 15th man and barely get any game time, but you can still absolutely have a winner's mindset. You know, because you're going to do the best you can with what you have where you are. If you know you don't get a lot of game minutes, you're the 15th man, you're a role player, you take pride in practices and workouts. You take pride in pushing the starters during practices and workouts. You know, you treat every single drill in practice as if it's game 7 of the NBA finals. You don't sit on the end of the bench pouting and complaining and blaming the coach for why you don't play. And then you get in for the last 30 seconds of a blowout and you just casually go through the motions because you don't think it cares. You don't think it matters. So you don't care. That's not an elite mindset. And let me say in full transparency, the reason I'm so passionate about this is because that what I just described was exactly the player I was in college. I did not get very much playing time after my freshman year, and I was the king of blaming, complaining, and making excuses. It was everybody's fault except for mine. You know, I was so scared and so insecure and so selfish, to be honest, that I never had the personal accountability or the extreme ownership to recognize the reason I wasn't playing was because I wasn't putting in the work. I wasn't focusing on the things I had control over. I wasn't coming in early and staying late and working on my game during the unseen hours. You know, I found it much easier, as most people do, to blame, complain, and make excuses. So I speak with the, you know, the enthusiasm of a convert, because all of these things I'm sharing, I'm not saying with judgment. I was that person in my younger years, and it didn't lead me anywhere fulfilling. So that's why I decided to make a shift. So yeah, if you can learn to focus on those things you have control over, learn to release and untether and let go of the things you don't, and learn to love the process. Don't be so consumed by outcomes, but be more consumed with the process. But keep in mind, again, I am a realist. I know that results matter. I know that winning and losing matters. I know that the outcomes matter, but I've also learned that the best way to get the outcomes that you prefer is to focus on the process. You know, I mean, let's look at the game of basketball. Let's not make this any more complicated than it needs to be, because I'm a believer that complexity undermines execution. You know, one of the biggest mistakes coaches make and players make is they make things unnecessarily too complex. But we have all agreed around the globe unanimously that basketball is a finite game, and the team with the most points on the scoreboard when the final buzzer goes off is declared the winner. It's not arbitrary. There's nothing subjective about that. Now, you might not like who won, or you might think the referees had an influence over who won. But at the end of the day, the team with the most points when that buzzer goes off is the winner. End of discussion. All right. Well, if we know that, what gives your team the best chance to have the most points on the scoreboard at the end of the game? Well, I'll tell you, it's only two things. Number one, on offense, you take the highest percentage shot possible as consistently as you can. And on defense, you make your opponent take the lowest percentage shot possible as consistently as you can. That's it. You do those two things. If every offensive possession, you take the highest percentage shot you're capable of, and every defensive possession, you make your opponent take the lowest percentage shot, I'm going to go ahead and say you will get the favorable outcome most of the time. But then we have to unpack that further. Well, what goes into getting the highest percentage shot possible? Well, now there's a lot of nuance. Now that is not as easy. Now it has to do with the players on your team and what's a good shot for them and how well do you move the ball and, you know, what type of offense do you run? And, you know, there's a lot of things that go into that. But at the end of the day, every time on offense that you as a player do something that takes away from your team's ability to take the highest percentage shot possible, in that moment, you just gave your team less of a chance to win. So if you choose to jack up a selfish shot that's out of your range, you just in that moment just gave your team a little bit less of a chance to win. If you chose not to set a solid screen to get an opponent open for a shot, in that moment, you just did something that gave your team less of a chance to win. Same thing on the other end. Because you chose to jog back on defense instead of sprint back, you just gave your team less of a chance to win. You know, because you played Ole defense and you just let your man drive right by you straight to the basket, you just gave your team less of a chance to win. Now, keep in mind, basketball is not a perfection game. And as human beings, we're not designed for perfection. So all of those things I just mentioned can and will happen during the game. And they can and will happen to really good players and really good teams. But the goal is to cut down on the percentage of those things happening. So once again, we make things way more complicated than they need to be.
Yeah, you get me fired up here because, you know, the role that you were talking about, I mean, that was my role in college as well. It's like, you know, I scored 7 career points I talk about in college. And I love every single point. I take pride in every single point. But it goes back to, you know, controlling what you can control. And you talked about doing everything you can to score more points than the other team. Well, sometimes your role in that might not be the guy who actually puts the ball in the basket or gets the defensive stop. It might be the guy that's on the end of the bench or the guy that shows up to practice to make sure the guy that's going to take that shot can actually take that shot over good defense instead of just not showing up that day. So I love that. I love that. I want to switch topics a little bit here to fundamentals. I went back and I went back to the book, to your first book, Raise Your Game, which if you haven't read it, audience, please go read it. It's amazing. And I turned to the first page. I had all sorts of notes and highlights and post-it notes. And My note was three words. It says, embrace the unsexy. And that was right next to one of the lines that you wrote. I've seen people fail or succeed based on their commitment to the unsexy, the unpopular, and the unglamorous. Can you expand on that a bit? I mean, that's like it seems so simple, but it's so powerful. And I think, you know, whether it's your, and I know you've told it a million times, whether it's your Kobe Bryant story or another elite performer story, like, expand on how important fundamentals are and just absolutely dominating the fundamentals.
Well, the fundamentals or the basics are the foundation to which the rest of the house is built. And, you know, obviously in the game of basketball, the fundamentals of the game are shooting, passing, defending, rebounding, and handling the ball. But in any area of life, there are core fundamentals. There are basic building blocks to be good at anything. I mean, whether you're trying to be a good coach, a good podcast host, a good author, a good speaker, I mean, you fill in the blank, there are fundamentals. And it's been my experience that the key to being an elite high performer in any area of life is being crystal clear on what those fundamentals are and then working relentlessly towards mastery of them, primarily during the unseen hours. But as you just said, in most industries, most of the fundamentals, they're not sexy. They're not flashy. They're not glamorous. You know, I can say with full admission that many times the fundamentals, they feel monotonous. They feel mundane. They can feel boring. But that's where you have to be able to dig a little deeper and say, there's nothing boring about mastering anything. There's nothing boring about winning. There's nothing boring about knowing that these fundamentals and my mastery of them is what will allow me to be elite in this specific vocation or in the game of basketball. So you have to, again, I said it before, you have to learn how to love the process, not just love the result. You know, as a basketball player, if you only enjoy the games and you hate practices and workouts, there is a ceiling on how good of a player you can become, you know? And that's understandable. Once again, I'm not saying that through the lens of judgment. I don't think many players would argue that games are more fun than practice and workouts. But historically, when you look at some of the best players to ever play the game, you know, and you mentioned Kobe Bryant, like they loved working out. They loved practice. They loved putting in that work. That was their laboratory, if you will. You know, that's where they realized this is where I can actually make an improvement on my game and on myself is during these unseen hours. So you have to learn how to fall in love with the process. And the nice thing is when you do learn to love the work, when you learn to love the process, when you learn to love, as cliche as it sounds, the journey, then you've already won in advance. Like, that's the thing. I really enjoy my job as a keynote speaker. Like, there's so many aspects of it that just give me so much fulfillment. But I actually love all of the aspects of it. It's not just the being on stage. Yes, being on stage and seeing eyes widen and people smiling and heads nodding and hearing applause absolutely fills me up. It makes me feel amazing. I would never say otherwise, but that's not the only part of the craft that I like. Like, I like doing the due diligence. I like the rehearsal. I like getting to know clients and getting to know audiences before I step on stage. Like, I enjoy working on new content and material and practicing stories. Like, I love all of that. So for me, because I love all of it, by the time I get on stage, that's just the reward. That's just the cherry on top of the sundae. You know, it's not like I'm trudging and grinding through mud just to be able to have an opportunity to step on stage. I love everything that goes into it. And same thing with basketball. You know, when you learn to love workouts and film sessions and strength and conditioning sessions and practice as much as you love the games, you've raised the ceiling of the level of player that you can become.
Yeah, and all that stuff kind of falls under the category of unseen hours, right? And for those who might not know what that term means, it's the things that you do behind the scenes that nobody sees. And so on that topic, I have a question for you because obviously we live in a documented world now, right? We live in a social media world, and whether it's some of the NBA all-stars that you see their workouts or their highlights, everybody seems to have a workout guy or a document guy, right? How do you personally balance the importance of social media and actually exposure and understanding that it can be impactful, and then also having those unseen hours still remain unseen for the actual literal meaning of that term?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, first and foremost, I think each person needs to get crystal clear on why they choose to use social media. Like, what is your goal for using Instagram or LinkedIn or I guess we call it X or Facebook? You know, for me, I use social media for three primary reasons. Number one, I use it to learn. So I have very high discernment over who I subscribe to and who I follow, because I want to follow, you know, I know it's a weird term, but thought leaders, you know, who are really getting me to think, feel, and act differently. People that challenge my conventional point of view. So first and foremost, I use social media to learn. It's one of the primary resources that I use to take in new information. Number two, I use social media to share. By definition, as a keynote speaker and an author, I'm trying to put content out into the world that people find valuable, that people find enriching and helpful, both personally and professionally, individually and organizationally. And social media is just another platform to do that. It's not lost on me how fortunate I've been over my career to be able to work with some of the players and coaches I've had a chance to work with and some of the businesses I've had a chance to work with. And I've always believed in paying it forward. You know, I live by the mantra that a candle loses nothing by lighting another candle. And ultimately, on a figurative level, if you were to ask me what my job in life is to light other people's candles. And social media is a way for me to do that. So I use it as a platform to share. Now, I choose not to share a whole lot of my personal life. I choose to rarely share any political point of view or anything topical. You know, that's just my preference. And everyone has the right to use their platform how they want. I choose to use social media as a way to share what I consider to be evergreen content that most human beings would find helpful for their personal and organizational development. So I use it to learn, I use it to share, and then I use it to engage. I use social media as a tool to meet people, to come across people like yourself that we may have never had a chance to meet if it wasn't for, you know, social media and podcasts and some of these other digital spaces. So it's a great opportunity for me to grow my network and to actually engage. And in so many different instances, you know, I've met somebody on social media and then eventually met them in person, and either a personal or a professional friendship ensues after that. So yeah, I use it to learn. I absolutely use it to share, and I use it to engage. Now, with that said, as far as my actual job as a keynote speaker, there are three primary things that I focus on. Anything outside of these three, I delegate to somebody else on my team to do. You know, and the first of those things is to promote. I need to promote my speaking services. You know, I basically am a 100% commission-based business, so I need to promote. And the primary way that I promote is what we just talked about, on social media. I try not to promote in a heavily salesy way. I try not to make my social media about look at me, look at me. I try to do content marketing where I'm sharing things of value. And if somebody consumes enough of that, then they might go, hey, why don't we just have this guy come speak to our team or come speak at our event? So the reason that I share on social media and the reason I love being a guest on podcasts like this is to promote my business. Number two, I put a lot into preparation. I've already mentioned that I enjoy the work behind the scenes. You know, I prepare by doing my due diligence when I'm going to go speak to a company. I learn everything I can about their audience and their event and the theme and their core values so that I can customize a program that will really, you know, be personalized and hit the mark for them. I prepare on my due diligence. I prepare with rehearsal. I prepare by creating and trying out new content. I prepare my body and mind to show up well rested, to give my best. So I'm going to promote. I'm going to prepare. And then the third one that I focus on is then I got to perform. You know, when I step on stage, that is my game day. And I'm very thankful people pay me a fairly sizable amount of money to step on stage and do something that I absolutely love to do. But don't get it twisted. I'm there to deliver. They are paying me for a service. And I take so much pride in my work that I absolutely want to over-deliver. You know, I want that performance to be the best that I'm capable of at that time. So I, you know, like I said, that is my game. So for me, those are the three things that I spend almost all of my professional life doing are those three things. And if it's not about promotion, preparation, or performing, then I try to outsource it, delegate it to someone else, or I just don't do it at all.
I love the focus. You talked about obviously being a keynote speaker. So you've been hired by some of the biggest companies in the world, you know, whether it's American Express, Starbucks, Spotify, Pepsi, you name it, right? So what are some of the traits of the leaders that you get to meet and you get to learn from that make them and their companies so successful? What have you found over the years?
Well, the cool thing is it's very similar to some of the best coaches that I've ever been around, you know, who certainly epitomize the word leadership. But, you know, a few of the traits that jump out, number one, leaders are able to cast vision. They make sure that everyone on the team, whether their team is 10 people, 10,000 or 100,000 team members, they make sure those folks know exactly what the North Star is. You know, they know what they're pursuing. They're crystal clear on their mission, on their vision, on their core values. You know, there's no ambiguity. They're telling everybody on the team, this is where we're going and this is what we're going after. They also do an awesome job of making sure that everybody on the team knows their role and the position they need to play in order to get there. And part of knowing that role, you know, is making sure that everybody on that team knows their actual role, embraces their role, and then aims to star in their role to the best of their ability. But what great leaders also do is they make sure everyone else on the team values, respects, and appreciates everybody else's role. You know, we were talking basketball earlier. The best basketball teams I've been on, the leading scorer and the star player and the starters have so much reverence and support and respect for the guys that don't play a lot. You know, the starters are giving high fives to the 15th man during practice because they know the sacrifice that person makes in order for them to be a starter and to be a star player. Well, it's the same thing in business. Everybody needs to respect and value and appreciate everybody else's role. And when you look at some of these really large companies, some of the ones that you mentioned, they have different departments and different silos. You know, you've got the leadership team, you've got the sales team, and you've got marketing, and you've got research and development, you know, you've got HR. You know, there are so many different silos, and the elite organizations are the ones that can step outside of those silos and show respect and appreciation for their teammates. You know, it's the sales professionals understanding that the admin staff and support staff are invaluable to their ability to sell at a high level, or R&D is invaluable to their ability to sell a product or service at a high level. So they don't look inwardly and just say, you know, my role and my department is what's most important. They realize they are all playing the ultimate team sport and that they all have to be able to get along, if you will. And with that, great leaders also make sure that they create the type of culture that everyone on the team feels safe. Everyone feels heard. Everyone feels valued. Everyone feels respected. Everyone feels like they're making a meaningful contribution to the group. You know, those, and all of that falls under the umbrella of culture. And when you get that right, then you'll see teams that are very collaborative, teams that have great cohesion, again, even across departments. But it always starts with leadership. In fact, I'll be as bold as to say everything starts and stops with leadership. You show me a very high-performing organization, and I promise you, not just one, but there are several leaders at work behind the scenes on that. And the other thing is, elite-level leaders, they know that they may have been given a position of authority. You know, my title is CEO, and I'm at the top of the org chart, but they view it very differently. If they have a 100-person company, they don't view it as, I've got 99 people that work for me. They flip it. They show up every day going, I have to work for 99 people. I'm here to be of service to every single person on this team. Even the lowest box on the org chart, you know, the temp or the you know, intern, you know, the CEO says, I'm still there to be of service to them. I'm there to add value to their life and to help bring them along. So they have that type of view. And then they also understand that leaders should not be singular. You know, when you have an organization, you don't have a leader. You should have an entire organization of leaders, that everyone on that team, regardless of title or tenure, should feel empowered to lead in the role that they have, should feel empowered to make sure their voice is heard, should feel empowered to make sure that they're doing everything they can to make a maximum contribution, that they're going to lead from wherever they are. So elite organizations don't have a leader. They have an entire team of leaders.
Yeah, and I love that everything you're saying, it should and could resonate with quite literally anybody who's listening. whether it is a Fortune 500 company or it's a middle school basketball team, right? It's the they're one and the same, right? Being a leader of a company or being a leader of a team or being a leader of yourself, they have the same characteristics. So as we start to wrap up here, I feel like most podcasts that I listen to or most social media that you see, you for the most part, you only see the highlights, right? Not many talk about the down parts and more importantly, how to get past them. So one of the topics that you talk about a lot is having that, and it might be one of my favorite phrases ever, having that next play mentality. Like my high school coach said it, my Tom Warren College said it. I guess my question is, can you talk to me about that mindset of having the next play mentality? And more importantly, if somebody is in a rut right now and they're going through it and they can't seem to see what that next play is, how do they get through it?
Well, for context, next play simply means don't worry about the play that just happened. Focus on the play that's right in front of you right now, the next play. And in basketball, it's a super easy visual and analogy. The imagery is right there in front of us. You know, don't worry about the missed layup, next play. Don't worry about the turnover, next play. Don't worry that the referee didn't call a foul, next play. Don't take the negative energy of something that's in the past, that's in the rearview mirror, that is literally unchangeable. Don't drag that into the present. So it's just wiping the slate clean. It's called having a whiteboard memory. You know, no matter what was written on that whiteboard, just wipe it clean and you've got a fresh slate and a fresh start. And this applies to every area of life. You know, this applies to if you have a disagreement with your significant other or one of your children. This applies if you're a sales professional and your first three sales calls of the day did not go the way that you'd preferred. You know, are you dragging that negative energy and the past into the fourth sales call? Or can you wipe the slate clean and completely refocus and recalibrate and dial in for that next one? So for me, next play, this whole mentality has been an absolute game changer. And like many of the things that we've talked about, if not all of the things we've talked about, it's not easy to do. You know, it's easy to talk about. It is incredibly difficult when you're in a low mood or you feel like you're in a slump or you feel like you're stuck. It's really challenging to have the courage, if you will, and the optimism and the mental fortitude to just wipe it clean and move to the next play. So I'm not by any means saying it's easy, but it is an incredibly powerful framework. I use that, I mean, literally dozens of times every single day of my life, you know? But what's interesting is we tend to talk about it as if whatever just happened was unpreferred or was quote unquote negative, but we have to move to the next play even when things go really well. You know, we see this all the time, especially at lower level sports. You know, a kid hits a three and then he spends the next 8 seconds dancing around and shimmying around and making all sorts of different hand gestures. And then his man scores a layup on the other end. It's like, no, you made a three. Congratulations. That's what you're supposed to do. But you need to move to the next play. The next play is get back on defense immediately. So same thing, you know, we can easily get complacent. If you knock it out of the park on your first four sales calls, and then you say to yourself, well, I'm just going to mail it in for this fifth one. I'm just going to ride this momentum. And you start to get complacent. Well, that's when you're going to get bit. That's when you're going to get snuck. So you need to be able to say, I'm so thankful that the first four calls went well. But the first four calls don't guarantee me success on the fifth call. I need to be dialed in and ready to move to the next play, which is the next thing right in front of me.
Yeah, it's a mental model that I love that could quite literally be used for anything. Man, well, you've had quite the career here. I'm always fascinated by entrepreneurs like yourself and inspired by entrepreneurs like yourself. Just to be keeping it real, sharing the ups, sharing the downs. And so one question I have for you as we, again, wrap up is looking back over your years of starting businesses, going through ups, going through downs, what's one thing that you wish you did differently or I guess that you know now that you wish you knew earlier?
I mean, the list of things that I wish I would have known previously that I know now, I mean, we'd have to record for another 5 hours.
Never ending.
Yeah, most things. But what I've learned to do, and this can actually be the lesson, is I've learned to give myself some grace and I've learned to give myself permission to be less than perfect. I've reminded myself that at any point in my life, even when I was an incredibly boneheaded, you know, teenager and in my early 20s, at that time, I was still doing the best I could with the tools I had. I just had very low self-awareness. I just had, you know, I wasn't very mentally tough. I didn't have very high emotional intelligence. You know, when I look back on it, and I don't say those things in judgment, I say them with the accuracy of hindsight, but, you know, at every step of my life, even when I've made some of the biggest mistakes and said some of the dumbest things, and as I mentioned, had an awful attitude when I was a college basketball player, but at that time, that was simply the coping mechanism that I thought would get me through a tough time. I actually thought that, you know, that was the best way to deal with my fear and my insecurity and my low self-esteem. So I'm not going to punish myself now for 25 years ago doing what I thought was right at the time. The only reason I know that it's not right now is because I have the gift of hindsight. So the number one thing is when I look back on my life, whether I did something well or I did something poorly, just reminding myself that I did the best I could at that time with the information I had, that I most likely lacked information and lacked self-awareness and lacked the tools that I may have now to make that a better decision. But you know what I can say with a huge smile? I can say the same thing about the present tense. You know, if you have me on your podcast 10 or 20 years from now, I promise you there are things that I'm doing right now in my life that at some point I'm going to look back on and go, man, why did you do it that way? Why did you? So, you know, from an operating system and a framework standpoint, we just got to do the best we can in the moment. And we have to learn how to let go of and forgive our previous selves for some of the things we've said or done. And it doesn't mean that those things were right, doesn't mean they were okay, and certainly doesn't mean we'll do them again. It just means at that time we did the best we could. And where this is a super helpful framework, especially for me, is I try to give every person I meet that same grace. If I meet someone and they say or do something that I think is foolish or boneheaded or closed-minded, I just give them the benefit of the doubt that that's not their intention. They're literally navigating the world the best they can, just like I am. And I'm not in any position to judge them. And, you know, talk about bringing something totally full circle. That's really how I look at the shopping cart thing now, you know, whereas years ago, I would judge and chastise someone. You know, I can't believe that you abandoned your cart. You are lazy. You are selfish and you are entitled. And instead, I now give them grace and space and go, I have no idea why that person abandoned their cart, but I'm sure they're doing the best they can with the tools they have. And it's not a hard thing for me to go put their cart back for them. So it's really not that big a deal.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, look, before we officially sign off, I have for all my guests what I call a sports business lightning round. I just fired some questions at you real quick and you got to hit me with the first thing that comes to your mind.
Perfect.
All right, here we go. What's your favorite color?
Blue.
Do you prefer coffee or tea?
I don't drink either. I don't do any caffeine.
Wow, that might be the first guest. Do you prefer pizza or pasta?
Pizza.
Would you rather be able to speak to all animals or speak four languages fluently?
Four languages fluently.
What is your favorite country outside the one you're in right now?
Brazil.
Mm. What's one of your biggest strengths?
I care.
Who is one of the first people to really believe in you?
My parents.
What's one of your biggest fears?
metaphorically and on the large scale, death. Something that's a little bit humorous, clowns.
A few more here. If you could have dinner and drinks with anyone in the world, dead or alive, who's one of the first people that pops into your mind?
Eminem.
Mm. And if you could turn back time and talk to 18-year-old Alan, what would you tell him real quick?
Well, 18-year-old Alan would not listen to what almost 50-year-old Alan would say. But what I would tell him is everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to work out. Just go through, you know, life with open eyes, open ears, and a big heart.
I love it. Well, you crushed the lightning round, man. This was amazing. I appreciate you coming on. I have pages worth of notes in addition to my post-it notes from your book. If you haven't read his books, Raise Your Game, Sustain Your Game, definitely order it. And yeah, man, I appreciate you coming on. I've learned a lot from you, even though we haven't met yet. And hopefully next time we can meet in person sometime in a gym soon.
That would be awesome. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thanks again for listening, my friends. If you enjoyed the episode or if it brought you any value at all, it would mean the world to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. If you share it on social media, make sure you tag me at Kevin Tarka. If there are any topics that you want me to dive into or any guests you'd love for me to have on the show, Just shoot me a message and I will do my best to make it happen. Have an amazing day and hope to see you back here soon.